Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 28 of our Disney Bracket. This week we'll be discussing 1994's The Lion King as well as 2010's Tangled.
As per usual for this round of our bracket, we're going to be talking about how they got here. So, what went up against Tangled and Lion King?
In round one, The Lion King went up against Oliver and Company.
Oh yeah, that unfair fight.
We're literally asking a kitten to fight a lion.
Oliver and Company is a really good, like, demarcation point between that era of Hollywood and what came after.
Do you mean that era of Disney and what came after?
Yes. Yes, that. I mean, Disney, Hollywood, same thing in the next decade or so.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. And then it went up against
The Little Mermaid in round two.
Right. And that was fairly rough for me. Less so for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would have preferred Zootopia move on in the Little Mermaid versus Zootopia matchup, but the audience spoke. But yeah, I understand your inner turmoil in axing a Howard Ashman film.
Yeah, there's that. But Lion King does have a stronger plot, better visuals, all that jazz.
Whereas Tangled in round one went up against Frozen, because of course.
Right.
It was really interesting that those two were matched against each other in round one.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave us a lot to talk about because they are very, very similar films.
And understanding why Tangled was successful where Frozen wasn't, despite working with very similar production ethoses, was illuminating.
Although, whether our assessment of one being successful and one not lines up with the general audience considering how huge Frozen got is up for question.
And again, we're evaluating this some years on, as opposed to in the immediate moment, and Frozen, I guess, kind of tapped into what the world needed at the time.
I think it was that moment that people realized that Disney was back.
Yeah.
And then, in the next round, we had Tangled going up against Chicken Little. I'm not sure what's more one-sided, that or Lion King against Oliver and Company.
I'm gonna say Tangled versus Chicken Little, because I can understand why a person might have a lot of nostalgia for Oliver and Company, and I'm not sure if anybody our age has that kind of nostalgia for Chicken Little.
Except for my wife.
Except for your wife, yes. Sorry, Courtney.
It's okay, I don't understand it either.
There's one in every family. Two in mine. And so now we have Tangled versus Lion King.
Which, after this, we'll finish off the quarterfinals of our bracket.
Ooh.
All right, where do we want to start?
Okay, so I have it highlighted and pointed to with three different colors of arrows so we don't forget. We need to talk about the Mr. Pig line.
Thank you.
And I'll let you take that away because you did the research. Have fun with that. Bye.
So, we've talked about this briefly. I'm not sure how much of it has ended up in the final cut of our Lion King episodes. But during the climax confrontation of the Lion King, there's the scene with Timon being chased by hyenas into the cage that Zazu is in.
Let me out!
And then, as the hyenas are about to devour them both, Pumbaa comes in and stops them, and then is called a pig, and he gets incensed about it.
Are you talking to me?
Shouldn't have done that.
Are you talking to me?
Now they're in for it.
They call me Mr. Pig!
When we talked about why Pumbaa shouldn't be incensed by being called a pig, considering that he's been called a pig numerous times throughout the film already, and it's never bothered him before. However, we haven't gotten into the issues with the film that they are referencing with this joke. So, the line is a slight change to "They call me Mr. Tibbs" from In the Heat of the Night from 1967, which is about the character named Virgil Tibbs, who is a black police detective from Philadelphia who becomes involved in a murder investigation in small town Mississippi. Being small town Mississippi in the mid-60s, you can understand that Mr. Tibbs is going to run into quite a bit of racism. And that line is specifically shouted by Mr. Tibbs while encountering the racism of the sheriff's department in that Mississippi town.
Virgil, that's a funny name for a that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
The moment is so iconic that they used that line for the title of the sequel film that came out in 1970. There's a lot of issues with trying to homage the film in that way, but specifically having a white person do that line, especially when they are yelling it at two characters who are being voiced by people of color. It also doesn't really make a lot of sense to be there. The kids are obviously not going to get it, and you assume that in 1994, you figure the parents are probably going to be somewhere between 25 to 30 years older than their kids. So if you assume a 5-year-old kid, rough max age for a parent is going to be around 40. That means that in 94, they were 40, they would have been 13 when this film came out. I doubt many 13-year-olds would remember this film. And I mean, it's an iconic quote. It's been remembered as culturally significant and whatnot. But them doing an homage and a reference to this film feels more like a fun thing for the production team to do as opposed to for the audience. And that's fine to have, but they're not really putting in a lot of thought or effort into how to do it well.
There are other, like, fun references in here. Like, there's a bit of a song where Timon quotes Romeo and Juliet. There's that one, like, iconic Disneyland song that Zazu sings. But those are all short and sweet and not a whole, like, sub-scene on their own during the climax of the film.
There's even references to Bruce Lee with Rafiki fighting off the hyenas.
Right.
Little homages like that, I think, are totally fine. But this one is much more significant than all of those and much more poorly done. So, that's finally out of the way.
Yay.
Hopefully it makes it in the edit.
So, let's talk about something a bit lighter. What movie has stronger action? Because I have some thoughts on this, but I'd like to hear yours first.
As far as stronger action, I'm going to have to go with Tangled.
Interesting.
As much as we have had some issues with how long the scene in the abandoned quarry goes, it has some wonderful action sequences. The short, quote-unquote, sword fight between Eugene and Maximus is great, as well as all the swinging between Eugene and Rapunzel. Eugene kind of sliding down the spillway. Not spillway, but the
aqueduct.
Yeah, I guess you could call it an aqueduct.
Yeah.
It looks like it's used for, like, transporting slurry.
The slurriduct.
Mm. Then you have the chase scene at the beginning of the film. Even some of the acrobatics that the thieves pull off to get to the crown. And we've also talked in the past how the action sequences in The Lion King aren't that great. The fight between Simba and Scar at the climax feels really hollow. There's not any weight behind those blows, and they kind of slow things down to make you feel like it's more important than it is.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you about the Scar fight, but this watch through, I was noticing that a lot of the other action scenes feel like they have some weight to them. Tangled has fun action, but I feel like a lot of it is comedy action and more slapsticky, whereas a lot of Lion King has moments where the character's motion in a scene is important, especially during the iconic throwing Mufasa to his death bit. It's really important for us to know where Mufasa, Scar, and Simba are at all times, and they do a good job of letting us know exactly where Simba is so that he can't see what Scar is doing, so that it sets up the dramatic payoff. And the fights with Nala in the latter part of the film, I feel like they are big weighted creatures moving around.
I will agree with you about the gorge scene. It has some amazing camera work and framing and shot composition. It's incredibly well done, especially the way they use the zoom in, zoom outs, and kind of casting these characters in shadow. It works incredibly well. Tangled has a lot of great camera work as well. I hesitate to put one over the other. They're both good. They are good in different ways.
Right. And I think also the way that they're good complements their story. Tangled is a bit more
whimsical.
More whimsical. And Lion King is a little bit more serious and Shakespearean.
Mm-hmm.
While we're here, speaking of camera moves, there are many beautiful shots in The Lion King, but there's a bit where the camera pivots and they do a like CGI version of Pride Rock for that one shot, but then it goes back to being a flat painting for the rest, and it's really noticeable if you're looking for it now. And I feel bad for seeing it, so now I can't unsee it.
I did not see that for whatever reason. I did, however, notice the CG animation on the wildebeests during the stampede. Honestly, it's pretty decent.
Yeah.
It holds up pretty well. I can tell that they are computer animated, but they blend in well enough that unless you're really looking for it, it's going to be fine.
It's kind of like the orcs in some of the Lord of the Rings, especially like the big army scenes. Mm-hmm. You know deep down that they're CGI, but they're well integrated enough that for a second your brain can forget it.
Part of the big tell is how they all have pretty much the exact same run cycle animation.
Right.
I think if they varied it a little bit more, you wouldn't have been able to tell nearly as much.
At the same time, the motion and energy and music of the scene kind of makes you not think, like, they probably had about 18 frames per wildebeest. They're like, oh god, Simba, no, run!
Yeah. Speaking of the gorge scene, right before it happens, Simba is talking with Scar, and he's like, oh, your father has a surprise for you, wait right here. And Scar is trying to make sure that Simba stays right there while he goes off and the stampede starts. And he talks about,
this is just for you and your daddy. You know, a sort of father-son thing.
And the amount of disdain in Scar's voice as he delivers that line really gives you an understanding of Scar's relationship with his own father.
Mm-hmm. But moreover, Scar is kind of a disdain for everybody who isn't him. Mufasa, Simba, even the hyenas are just a means to an end.
Although, I question his disdain for Mufasa, especially as we see after he takes the throne how insecure and small he feels when compared with Mufasa.
Yeah.
There's also some weird stuff at the beginning of the film with Scar. When we first see him, he's playing with the mouse, and he talks about,
life's not fair, is it?
And that he will never be king. But at this point, he would have had to have been setting up his assassination/coup. It doesn't make sense that he wouldn't have already established a rapport with the hyenas and was getting ready to pounce. So I'm not sure if it's like, we're going to introduce his character and throw you off the plot of the film, or whether it's just, I don't know, maybe a line of dialogue that got missed in rewrites, or what.
I have a different take on that, actually. I think that Scar abstractly wants to be king when the film starts, and it's not until around Be Prepared that he's actually setting in motion things that will lead inevitably to him being king. He has aspirations, but they don't become concrete until he's repeatedly stymied.
I think both of our interpretations are valid.
Yeah.
There's not lots to go on there. It's also really interesting how much Scar's physicality plays into his personality. He literally has a long face. It is longer and more narrow than both adult Simba as well as Mufasa. It's accentuated even more by that little tuft of fur at the end of his chin that is going to be sort of reminiscent of like a evil goatee beard. He also has these very prominent cheekbones and sunken cheeks that give him this very gaunt look, and he's also much more lithe and less muscular than Mufasa or Simba are. And it kind of gives you a little bit of foreshadowing of the state of the Pride Lands after he takes the throne. He's kind of weak and sickly, and that leads to a weak and sickly Pride Lands.
That tracks with the way he's either bad at hunting or thinks of it as beneath him. When he's king of the Pride Lands, he says that
it's the lioness's job to do the hunting.
And even when he's just a citizen of the Pride Lands, he's eating mice. That mouse isn't going to be more than a snack, really. He might be able to hunt, but it seems like he's more a fan of trickery than brute strength. Mm-hmm. So I'd imagine that he doesn't eat well.
Also, I feel bad if I don't point this out, but there is a little bit of shittiness with that whole, like, sickly, frail aspect of Scar in association with evil. I don't want any of our listeners who may have chronic illnesses to feel put off by that.
And that's a pretty common Disney thing. I mean, you get the same thing with Jafar. Ursula is kind of the polar opposite.
I mean, I wouldn't even necessarily say it's Disney. I think it's just media in general.
Right. But especially with cartoons that tend towards abstracted forms to tell you what the characters are up to. And it does tie in with Scar's whole thing of being brains not brawn. Speaking of brains not brawn, we've talked about how Mother Gothel is manipulative. And there's a part of me that, I guess, respects her skill as a manipulator. Her ploy with the Stabbington brothers and offering them the crown crown in exchange for helping her get Rapunzel back and then betraying them had a lot of variables that could have gone wrong, and her executing it well is impressive. Not that I think that makes her a good person, but definitely I respect the cunning required in a way that makes her seem dangerous. Had Tangled been part of the Disney Renaissance, Mother Gothel would be a pretty common, like, Disney villain who recurs in Disney things, the way that, say, Cruella de Vil or Hades are. But also it kind of leads into how I'm realizing that Rapunzel picked up some of those traits. Rapunzel also has the ability to be manipulative when she wants to be. She doesn't use it for evil, and I'm not saying that all manipulation is a bad thing, but she definitely knows how to work a person's psychology, like the roughing of the Snug the Duck thing, or with Maximus, when she's convincing him not to arrest Eugene for 24 hours.
And it's also my birthday, just so you know.
And I really like that. It's showing them you can use these skills to good or evil ends, and being able to persuade people in certain ways is not necessarily a evil act. You get a good sense of exactly where Mother Gothel is coming from with why she's done everything. Towards the end of the film, after Eugene has been captured and they are back in the tower, Gothel is explaining how the world wants to destroy any ray of sunshine that they can. And the way she's describing everything at this point in the film, you realize that she's exactly describing what she's doing to Rapunzel. And that's why she feels that that's what the world will do to her, is because that's exactly what she's doing.
Question: do we think that there's a certain amount of tragicness to that, that she can't see the world any other way, or is that all just her manipulative aspect and she doesn't really think that? I'm not trying to, like, apologize for Mother Gothel, but we're like three rounds in and gotta, like, complicate the character somehow.
Yeah. She's hundreds of years old. I think she's just kind of set in her ways at this point.
Mm.
Instead of having the flower get used up completely to save the queen, she could have just offered her services and healed the queen that way and still wound up with the flower. Mm-hmm. And not have had to, you know, kidnap a princess. I don't really think there's any sort of way that Gothel is redeemable, especially with how they frame her death. Mm-hmm. As she's falling out the window, she's cast in the fading light of day. And there's this phrase that popped in my head and I thought was very appropriate for that scene, that sunlight is the best disinfectant. The sun is revealing Mother Gothel for exactly what she is. She is old and been here too long, and she has caused more harm than good.
It's well past her time.
Mm-hmm.
While we're on that scene, we talked before about the mirror breaking and that being keyed into the whole, like, Gothel's vanity breaking and...
Yeah, the shattering of the illusion.
All that jazz, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I like that with that, it's, I guess, a little bit foreshadowed, because when Rapunzel is realizing what Mother Gothel's up to, she backs up and knocks over things from her boudoir? Is that what you call it?
I'd say, like, vanity.
Yeah, she literally knocked over her vanity, part of that including the mirror, like, swiveling down and no longer being functional to show her the truth because she doesn't need it anymore. That scene has a lot of very clever small things, like, she wasn't painting the suns, she was painting the negative space where the suns would be, because they're missing. It's clever.
Both these films have a lot of symbolism between suns and light, and we talked about this last time with Lion King, and it definitely fits for Rapunzel. Both of our protagonists are effectively solar powered, one much more overtly than the other.
But also with, not Jafar, Jafar's fursona.
Scar.
With Scar being very clearly lunar, he keeps being framed by that crescent moon.
And Gothel, again, is also very lunar. Most of the time when we see her outside of the tower, it's nighttime. She very often has that lantern with that sickly green color that, honestly, now that I think about it, reminds me of the color of Scar's irises. I also noticed that Simba and Mufasa, their solar divine right is even shown via their coloration. They are a much more saturated golden brown than all the other lions, which are kind of this almost grayish beige.
Mm-hmm. And the solar thing works really well with the whole circle of life thing, so it tracks.
Yeah. Although, there's this weird thing I noticed. The color of Simba's sclera, the quote-unquote whites of the eyes, kind of switches back and forth throughout the film between white and yellow.
Mm.
and I can't tie anything to it. There's no significance that I can find, and it looks like it's just a weird production error.
It might be they didn't have a great grasp on how to make the irises look darker for scenes in shadow.
Possibly. It also happens with Nala a couple times, too. It's honestly kind of weird. Most of the speaking characters in the film have yellow eyes. I think the exceptions are Zazu, Timon, and Pumbaa.
Although it does track with that weird thing cats have where light reflects off the back of their eyes and lets them see in the dark better.
It's the same sort of thing with hyenas. I guess it's, you know, you can think of it as like predators, prey.
Although speaking of predators and prey and manipulators, I was realizing this time that Timon is an antagonist in this movie.
Interesting. Okay.
So what does Simba need?
He is cast out and he really needs someone to help him understand that his father's death isn't his fault, and then get him to go back and try to fix the thing that his uncle ruined.
Mm-hmm. And Timon's whole thing is, forget the past, don't think about it, we're not going to talk about it, put it behind you, you have no responsibilities, live carefree, nihilism is good, actually. It's not that Timon is a bad person, but he is directly opposed to what Simba needs to maximize his potential as a king of beasts. Timon and Pumbaa are functionally kind of like the Island of the Lotus Eaters in the Odyssey, or I guess Falstaff in the Henry plays.
I can totally see it.
Yeah. This is not to say that like Timon and Pumbaa aren't good characters. They happen to be narratively opposed to Simba for some of the narrative, but they do come around, which is good.
Yeah. My realization about Timon and Pumbaa is much less interesting than yours.
Oh, sure.
But I think a little more weird.
Oh, good. I love good and weird.
So, in a previous episode, we talked about how it's weird that Timon and Pumbaa are just, like, out in the desert harassing vultures.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized they are bowling for buzzards because they're getting them away from the animal carcasses so they can eat the carrion insects.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's the best explanation that I could come up with.
Yeah. Like, that, or they're just being dicks to birds. Like, either way, it's kind of a grim thing to do.
They impede Simba's growth, but after Simba effectively outgrows them, they become allies.
Lion King is very focused on Simba's interiority. It might be the most character study-y of the, I guess, Disney canon. I guess maybe Moana.
Although, someone who I think is a bad character and I don't think changes is Zazu.
No.
More and more watching this film, Zazu loves to wield Mufasa's strength and power, but whenever he's challenged without Mufasa there, he becomes a complete coward. And it goes even beyond that. Right before Just Can't Wait to Be King, Zazu is having a conversation with the cubs, and he tells them that
one day you two are going to be married.
Not only does Zazu tell them that they have no choice in their betrothal, but when Simba says that his first act as king will to be abolish the practice, Zazu says, not so long as I'm around.
What you gonna do, Zazu? Campaign for traditional marriage?
And it's just every time I watch this film, I question more and more why Mufasa has him as an advisor. There has to be someone better. Even if you still need a bird, there has to be a better bird.
A bird is a really good idea for a kingdom because then you can get places faster and carry messages. That's an excellent plan.
I'm really hoping that in the quote-unquote live-action remake that they change Zazu a little bit, because I would really like to not hate a John Oliver character.
My hope with that is that Scar gets him on his side. Consider, Zazu thinks that Simba is a bad choice to be king. Scar says, hey, I would be a better choice than Simba.
Ooh, I like it.
I'm not sure how that would go plot-wise because betrayals and stuff, but I feel like that would be a really interesting take that would complicate Zazu and Scar as a character.
So effectively turn Zazu into the Wakabi of the Lion King.
Pretty much.
Nice.
Yeah. Thank you.
I approve.
Thank you. I think I've mentioned it before that Mother Gothel is clearly based off of the Mother Gothel analog from Into the Woods, specifically Bernadette Peters' run as the witch who imprisons Rapunzel in the tower. I'm also seeing a lot of other similarities in character stuff that makes you wonder if like someone had seen it recently enough that it was just in their subconscious. Specifically, when Rapunzel is talking about seeing the lanterns, she talks about how she's not sure what she's going to feel and what if...
It's not everything I dreamed it would be. And what if it is?
Which is almost word for word part of a song that Cinderella sings in Into the Woods, where she's unsure how to feel about this whole going to a ball and being courted by the prince thing.
But then what if he knew who you were when you know that you're not what he thinks that he wants? And then what if you are?
Didn't the film adaptation come out just a few years prior to that film's release?
Yeah, I think Into the Woods was 2014, give or take. So I could see how there might have been people who were thinking about it even tangentially at the time.
And I mean, the film adaptation is also a Disney production, so pre-production might have been going on.
Hey gang, so in the original edit, we speculated that Disney's Tangled, which came out in 2010, was influenced by pre-production on Disney's Into the Woods, which came out in 2014. Reasonable, they have similar themes and all that jazz, but while I was doing the edit, I looked it up. Into the Woods didn't start pre-production until 2011, and because of how the conversation rambled on, there wasn't really a good way to transition seamlessly to the next point, so I didn't. To avoid an awkward subject change, I'm putting this bit in, and also this weird trivia that I found out. Apparently, the thing that inspired Disney to do an Into the Woods adaption was a speech by Barack Obama about solidarity after 9/11.
The art direction for this film is top-notch. It's probably within the top two or three Disney films of all time, as far as just how cohesive everything is visually. I'm incredibly impressed with the work that the various art teams have put into Tangled. It's really excellent.
And to be fair, Lion King is also up there as far as great visuals. Andy Gaskill, who did a lot of the art direction, also worked on Hercules and Treasure Planet and VeggieTales. And Strong Bad?
That's
world's most interesting art man.
That's a weird resume.
Yeah. And Lion King does look very Treasure Planet-y. It has some of the same, I guess, color palettes.
You could take negatives of The Lion King and that you can pop them pretty much directly into Treasure Planet, and I wouldn't be able to tell.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking a lot about Lion King. I want to jump into Tangled. Specifically, I want to start at the very beginning. So Eugene begins his narration with saying,
"This is the story of how I die."
Yes, he does die in the actual story, like physically. But as he's saying that line, it's showing us a wanted poster for Flynn Rider. And I think you can also very much interpret Eugene saying that as, this is the story of how Flynn Rider died and how I became, once and for all, Eugene Fitzherbert.
And he explicitly says,
"I started going by Eugene again,"
in the end narration, so that tracks really well. And speaking of that death, the first time I saw Tangled, I was young and naive and wrong and didn't like it very much. And part of that was I thought the whole tear healing Eugene at the end was a deus ex machina, which you could argue that it is. But then I went and read the original Brothers Grimm fairy tale. And in that story, Rapunzel finds her prince and he's been blinded by falling into some thorn briars or whatever, as princes are wont to do. And she cries on him and it fixes it. It was there in the canon and they found a way to make that fit without being just a complete deus ex machina.
Yeah.
So I can't be too mad about that.
Also, the way they desaturate everything during that death scene, and then as he's waking up, just slowly bring back all the color and let more light into the room is gorgeous.
And it's earned because we've had so many of these beautiful colors, and then whenever things get desaturated, things are bad. And it's an easy but effective visual shorthand. You also see that when Mother Gothel finds out that Rapunzel's gone, and then when Rapunzel meets the Sabington brothers.
While we're talking about Tangled, last time we discussed it, we talked about the mobile and how all the little individual things play into Rapunzel's journey. But there was a fifth one, and we couldn't quite make it out. I was able to pause at the right time and see it. And it's a blue bird with a yellow crest and stomach. And we see that bird when Rapunzel first leaves the tower. She runs into it, and I believe after she exits the little valley enclosed area that the tower resides in and goes through that cave, there's a flock of them. Again, the mobile pointing out all these things that are going to be important in Rapunzel journeys holds with that fifth piece.
And that's a pretty common fairy tale trope. Sorry, I've been reading a lot of Bruno Bettelheim, where at the start of the story, the hero or heroine is given 1d6 boons from their parents, and those wind up coming in handy. It's usually like, oh, I encounter an obstacle. Luckily, I have this thing in my pocket. Oh, I encounter another obstacle. I have this thing in my pocket. And it happens about 3 to 4 times. in the same way, like, the parents are kind of giving her these tokens that will guide her. Less obvious because, you know, it's not a direct retelling of the story. It's done subtly, which is really cool.
One last big thing that I want to tackle in Tangled. During the scene where Eugene is being led to the gallows, when they first come to get him, they're like,
"Let's get this over with, Ryder."
And he's like,
"Where are we going?"
And they just look at him, just like,
"Oh."
So he realizes that he is being led to his death. He knows exactly what's going on. And he just kind of accepts it. At this point, he's completely lost all hope. But as they're leading him through the dungeon, he sees over to his side one of the cells, the Stabbington brothers, who the last time he saw, they were kidnapping Rapunzel, or so he thought. And then immediately upon seeing him, knocks out both guards and frees his shackled hands so that he can grab the Stabbington that talks and press him for information. And then as the guards are trying to drag him off, fights them off as well. They're telling you so much about Eugene's emotional state during those few minutes, both after he fears that Rapunzel's been kidnapped and is gone forever, and once he gets that faint glimmer of hope that he can save her or be with her again. And there's this call to action. It's so well done, and they never point any of this out. It's just all body language.
Yeah, I love the "I could have broken out any time, but I chose not to" thing. It's a really fun narrative. Speaking of, I guess, grim accepting your fate stuff, Simba kind of has a similar accepting your doomed fate thing. Timon and Pumbaa rescue him from the desert, take him to the oasis, splash some water on his face. One of them says,
"You nearly died."
And then he just walks back out into the desert again. Simba was depressed to the point of being suicidal in that moment, which, understandable, but also really dark for a Disney film. That makes me very forgiving of him kind of embracing the whole Hakuna Matata thing, because he was definitely in a place where he needed to not feel his feelings for a bit.
I've spoken on my piece on both of these films, I think. I'm ready to make a decision.
I think I am too. I'm a little more excited about watching Tangled than I am about watching Lion King.
I'm in the exact same place.
Okay, yeah.
Watching Lion King this time through, like, I'm noticing all the little unpolished bits and things that are just not the greatest. But every time I watch Tangled, I get more excited about watching it again. And it just feels like such this quintessential Disney film. I think that's my reasoning for voting for it this week.
Lion King is definitely one of the Disney classics, but it is narratively and character storytelling-wise experimental, even if the animation is pretty, you know, standard for what they're doing at the time.
Yeah.
And it's a very good experiment, but I think it's also not an easy watch. And Lion King isn't an all-the-time movie, whereas Tangled is definitely one I can just put on and be like, you know, I feel like being happy for a little bit.
Yeah. Since we're talking about it, I'm interested to see what direction they will take the new adaptation of Lion King. Because I think that if they shake things up a bit, make a few changes, and polish up some of the parts that weren't well done in the animated version, I think it will be a really, really good film. But there's also kind of the track record that Disney has had with their live-action adaptations, and so far they've been pretty hit or miss. For every Jungle Book or Cinderella, we also get a Maleficent or Pete's Dragon.
Whatever else happens, I hope they hew as close as possible to the original bit where Rafiki is leading Simba through the Yoda cave. It's my favorite part of the movie because I love the weird, almost psychedelic aspect to that.
Well, with that, the quarterfinals of our bracket are finished. We have 3 episodes left. So as we enter the semi-finals, we have 2 matches. Our next episode will be Moana versus Beauty and the Beast, and then after that it will be Lilo and Stitch versus Tangled. These are going to be some tough decisions.
Also, now every single film left on our bracket has a lady protagonist. Yay!
I believe when we originally started with our 32 films, it was maybe 50-50 or slight male lead.
And you had some kind of more ensemble narratives too in there.
Yeah, the cream has risen to the top.
And we're going to pour into our coffees next week, and we hope you join us. Until then, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Podbean.
Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Thank you for listening.